Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is freelance journalist and Macworld senior contributor, Kirk McElhern. Kirk, welcome.
Hi, John. It's good to be back on the show.
It is nice. This is your second appearance on the show, and I'm really happy to have you back. I've been an admirer of your work for a long time. For the listeners, as a reminder, Kirk is an expert technical journalist, all things Apple. He's known as the iTunes guy and has a regular column at Macworld. Still?
No, that ended last year.
Okay. And your career started in France as a translator of technical material, and that led to a career as a writer. And you've written many books about the Mac, as well as several Take Control books, including tutorials on iTunes, Audio Hijack, yay, which I'm using, and Scrivener, which I love, yay.
Great software, yeah.
Yeah, it is. I had science fiction writer on the show recently, and he just converted from, can you believe it, Emacs,
wow,
to Scrivener so he could collaborate with a friend.
Wow, okay. That wasn't Neil Stevenson, was it?
No, it was Stephen Bruce in Minneapolis.
Because Neil Stevenson is a real fan of the command line. I don't know if you ever read what it was originally an essay, but it was released in a book. I think it was called In Praise of the Command Line. Something he wrote about 20 years ago. It's really fascinating.
Neil Stevenson rings a bell. Is he a science fiction writer also?
Sure, yeah. He's written, he wrote Crypto something, and the Baroque trilogy, Snow Crash, which is one of the foundational cyberpunk novels.
Ah, yeah. Crypto Kyrillicon or something.
Yeah. Why can't I think of it? But it's a crypto something.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I had a fun time with Stephen talking about Roger Zelazny and Lord of Light and what inspired him to start writing. It was a good show. So, this show, we agreed to sit back and let our hair down and talk about Apple and photography. Apple has a long history of photography, both in hardware and software. And I take it you've become somewhat of an expert on Apple and photography and have a lot to say about it. So let's just kind of explore where Apple's been and what they're doing and maybe where they're going and Apple and photography. Sound good?
That's fine.
Okay, so how did it all start? I remember my flip phone had a camera. The one I had before my Motorola Razr, which was glorious. And it had a camera in it, but it was really hard to get the photos out. And then when the iPhone shipped, boy, was it a change. Getting photos onto my Mac was a breeze. It was so cool.
You don't remember the first consumer digital camera, do you? The Apple QuickTake.
I had one when I was at the Oak Ridge National Lab. I acquired a QuickTake camera. I used it to take pictures of the staff and put them on a local web server that I was running on a Quadra 700. Using Mac HTTP and had to give out this address like http://. And right there, people's brains froze. They were so used to Banyan Vines and Simple DOS. And as soon as you gave them a web address, their brains just hazed out on you.
Yeah. But it was the first consumer digital camera.
It was glorious.
It had a funny shape. It was kind of like a pair of binoculars with just one lens.
Yeah.
And then the second version looked more like a standard camera.
Charcoal gray, kind of. And it held about 12 pictures, didn't it?
Yeah. and it didn't. It was a 0.3 megapixel photo on the first one. And it was expensive, but it was a first generation device. And this came out around the same time as Apple first released a CD-ROM drive. I don't know if you remember that, but it was the size of a scanner today. It was incredibly heavy. I remember the box it was in, which I threw out when I moved from France to the UK 5 years ago, was big enough to put two cases of beer in it.
I don't remember the first CD.
This was a 1X. You know, we talk about 8X and 24X. This was a 1X CD-ROM drive back in the day. But Apple was doing these cutting-edge products at the time, and they didn't catch on because it was too early. The QuickTake, there were two models, the 100 and the 200, and they didn't last. And then everyone moved on to putting cameras in smartphones. I remember an early, one of those Nokia smartphones, you know, not a flip phone, and it had probably a 0.3 megapixel camera. And how many pictures do you take like that, honestly? As you say, they're hard to get them off. I remember I could get them off by connecting with a Bluetooth cable or probably, sorry, with a USB cable and probably Bluetooth, but it was always a hassle.
And there was always some sort of oddball, half-baked app you had to use to transfer the
Sort of transfer app, that wasn't really made for the Mac, and it was never comfortable. Mm-mm. But it's true that Apple did, with the iPhone, Apple did to photography what they did for music with iTunes. They made it easier to move things around.
I remember
to get the pictures off the iPhone.
I remember a WWDC or a Macworld. I can't remember which, where Steve Jobs was on stage and he was demoing iPhoto for the first time. And he was showing pictures of families and kids on the beach and memories of your children growing up. And he was saying something like, "This is why we do what we do." I think that may have been a trigger. What do you think?
Oh, it certainly was. iPhoto was released in 2002. And remember, iTunes was in 2001 and the iPod was in 2001. So it was, remember the whole digital hub strategy. It was part of that.
Yeah.
The idea that you could put these photos onto a CD-ROM or a DVD, that you could add music to them from your iTunes library. You know, we take all that for granted now. But back then, this was new. People were starting to look at photos on computers instead of projecting slides against a wall as they might have done decades earlier.
The glorious days when you transferred your photos to and burned them to a DVD and sent them to grandma.
Exactly, yeah. But remember also that this was free software from Apple. You didn't have to pay the Adobe tax. This was software that came with macOS, it was macOS 10 at the time. And it was like a slow buildup because this was 2002 and the first iPhone wasn't until 2007. The iPhone certainly was not the first smartphone to have a better camera. But as often, Apple wasn't the first, but improved things a lot. This said, the first iPhone had only a 2-megapixel camera, and that wasn't a very high resolution. It didn't get to 5 megapixels until the iPhone 4. Then the iPhone 4S was 8 megapixels, and then it didn't get to 12 megapixels until the 6X, the 6S, and it's been there ever since. So it's been the 6S, the 7, the 8, the iPhone 10 are still 12 megapixels, which puts Apple a little bit behind the other manufacturers right now. But Apple has always, and again, I'll make the parallel with iTunes, they've always made the hardware work with the software. You take your pictures with your iPhone, you connect them to your Mac, or you use iCloud, and everything shows up in your photos library just the same way that iTunes used to sync when people used to listen to music like that. Now everyone streams music. So the software, the combination of the software and the hardware make a user experience that's a lot better than some other devices. Give credit to Microsoft, because with Windows 10, they've improved that a lot too.
Wasn't it WWDC 2016 where Phil Schiller mentioned that each photo you take, there's something like 500 billion operations in a second or so that go into producing the actual image? All the processing.
Yeah, we have to remember that these are, I like to call my iPhone a pocket computer because I do use it to make phone calls, but that's not its main use. It is a pocket computer, and we're at the beginning now of what you call computational photography. And a good example of that is the portrait mode in the iPhone Plus models and the iPhone 10, where the two lenses work together to detect the subject and the background, to blur the background or to do certain effects. So we've gone beyond simply just taking a static picture of what's in front of the camera or the phone. And we're computing now. We're doing a lot of computing.
I love it. I love it.
And there's a lot of AI stuff that's being used in this. Just the other day, I saw something. It might be Google who's working out an AI system. So, you know, sometimes you take a portrait of someone and they just happen to be blinking when you shoot the picture.
Mm-hmm.
You get their eyes closed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Google that's coming out with a system to use AI to basically open the eyes, to replace the closed eyes with open eyes.
With another picture you took, or just sort of
presumably with another picture you've taken. Yeah.
Okay. Because you don't know the color of their eye is.
Right. But since your photo library now is a kind of a huge database, You know how Apple groups photos in Moments and all that. They're able to do this sort of thing. If you've got facial recognition and you've named some people in your photo library, it's very easy for the software to know who that person is and to substitute different things.
Can appeal to the library of previous photos of that person to achieve certain things, like you said, opening eyes maybe.
Exactly.
Wow.
And something else I saw this week was talking about how to use software, AI software, to take a normal video and make a slow motion video. So basically it will be interpolating frames between the existing frames because it knows where point A is in frame one and point A is in frame two. So it can calculate a path where point A will be in frame 1.5, right? So it'll be able to insert frames to make a slow motion video from what you have. I mean, we're really at the dawn of a new age in computing and photography.
That's fascinating. Fascinating. So do you think the all the new phones are going to have the dual dual lens? Or do you think that's just going to stay on the high end?
It's hard to know because there has to be a differentiating factor to sell the larger, more expensive phone or to sell the iPhone X. When you think that it's really quite difficult now to come up with new features for an iPhone or any smartphone. We can do everything we need to do, and even a faster processor doesn't make that much of a difference anymore. Apple and other companies are realizing that one of the things that gets people to buy new phones is a better camera. So they're certainly going to keep upping the features of the camera. And I really think that Apple's going to increase the resolution with this year's model to 16 or maybe 18 megapixels because 12 is starting to be a bit low. When the 6S came out, 12 was good compared to, say, a compact camera you could buy. But today you can buy an excellent compact camera with 18 or 20 megapixels.
So let me run something by you.
Okay.
Years ago, I learned that if you make the pixels too small,
yep,
that the dynamic range is compressed.
Right.
And the idea that you have a lot of pixels, sort of like the megahertz myth, is not a good idea. If you have too many pixels, the dynamic range is not so great.
Not entirely true. It is true on an absolute basis, but there's room to put a larger sensor in the iPhone. So you wouldn't just put more pixels in the same size sensor. You'd put a larger sensor where you'd be able to put more pixels.
Yeah, but then they're making the phone thinner and thinner. You don't have enough focal length to cover the larger CCD.
Yeah, and some of us wonder, why are they so obsessed with making the phone thinner? I would rather have more battery life than a thinner phone, personally. I have an 8 Plus now, and that's got much better battery life than the normal one. But I think the thin phone has kind of reached its limits.
Well, especially the way people wear their phones in the back pocket. Well, right? I think it was the 6S where they made the wrong choice of aluminum alloy and it tended to bend.
Yeah, and it was easy to bend.
Bit.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so. I'm still waiting for a carbon fiber iPhone. I don't know why they haven't done that yet. But it's possible. I don't know enough about this, but I think carbon fiber, it has a lot of tensile strength, but if you drop it, it's likely to shatter.
Okay.
But there is a trade-off with more pixels in the same size sensor, but there's also a problem with not enough pixels and not enough resolution. And one of the things about the iPhone is you can make some wonderful photos much of the time, but not all of the time. It's not always great in low light. When you're switching between the zoom and when you're switching between the wide angle and the telephoto lens, if there's low light, it'll do a digital zoom from the wide angle instead of using the telephoto. This is on the one with two cameras. So it's not really perfect. I mean, it could be better. And since Apple is competing against other brands, they have to catch up. Other brands are at 16, 18, 20 megapixels.
I'm glad you mentioned low light because I sense that what Apple's doing is instead of focusing too much on just resolution, they're focusing on, as you said, computational techniques to allow the average person to take really good photos in bad conditions where a normal photographer who has a complex camera would adjust the settings in the ISO
right.
and fiddle with the settings on a Nikon or a Canon to achieve the kind of photo that he wants under difficult conditions, and you don't have that liberty. Although I did find an app that allowed me to change the ISO and take photos on my app, on my phone. I forget what the app's name was. But normally
there's
you don't
a number
have that
of
much
apps
control.
That can do that, yeah. That sort of thing. Yeah, or let you shoot in RAW. But I think Apple's goal with the iPhone and photography is to make it good enough for almost everyone.
In every condition.
Well, in most conditions, yeah. It's I've done some low-light pictures that come out fairly well. There's noise, but you expect that. And I mean low-light without using the flash. It's never going to be as good as, I don't like to use the term real camera, but, you know, the difference between a DSLR, a Micro Four Thirds, a mirrorless camera. It's never going to be as good, or at least not for quite some time. But it is good enough for most people who want to take pictures of their family, pictures on vacation, pictures of their cats, because everyone has to have cat pictures.
My wife has an Icon 9100, and I think the ISO goes up to about 8,000 or something like that. And then she discovered that the Nikon 9200 has an ISO rating like 64,000. And I don't know what the maximum ISO on the iPhone is, do you? But it's not that high.
It's not very high, no. And I'm not sure what the maximum is. But a real camera going up, I'm just looking at my Fujifilm X100F. It goes to 12,800. That's not surprising for a real camera.
Mm-hmm.
But how often do you really need to shoot like that? The reason you want to shoot like that is because you can use a faster shutter speed in less light. It's not so much because you're shooting at night. And it's a relatively limited use case. If you set your ISO to automatic, it'll just do what it can do, which is what the iPhone does.
You're taking pictures of Le Mans at night and cars are moving really fast.
Yeah. And so you want a higher shutter speed. Yeah. But again, I think the iPhone is good for 90% of people in the photos they take. And I think that's a good target for Apple. There's never going to be an iPhone Pro camera model, I don't think. It's not Apple's demographic. They want a phone with a camera for everyone.
Well, it's time for us to take a break. When we come back in segment two, I want to ask you some more questions about Apple and photography. But folks, first we have to take a commercial break. Hi, this is John Marcellera with the Mac Observer. This week, our sponsor is Simple Contacts. If you wear contact lenses and find yourself dreading that annual appointment to renew your prescription, then you're going to love Simple Contacts. This new company makes an annoying process very simple. Simple Contacts lets you renew your expired contact lens prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from your phone or computer in minutes. Simple Contacts brings the doctor's office to wherever you are, whenever you need it. You can take the Simple Contacts vision test online in 5 minutes. A real doctor reviews it and renews your prescription. You save time, money, and save yourself a headache. And if you have an unexpired prescription, just upload a photo of it or your doctor's info and order your lenses in minutes for a great price. All the hard work is done for you. Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses and their prices are unbeatable. The prescription is just $20. Compare that with an annual appointment, which can be up to $250 without insurance. They have some of the best prices on contacts, and shipping is free. Best of all, listeners here will get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. Just go to simplecontacts.com/BGM or enter the code BGM at checkout. Note, by the way, that this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but this is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and renew your contacts if your vision has not changed. Again, check out Simple Contacts and get $30 off by going to simplecontacts.com/BGM or just enter the code BGM at checkout. Give it a try. And thanks, Simple Contacts, for being our sponsor. We're back. I'm chatting with Kirk McElhern, freelance technical journalist. So, iPhoto. You know, years ago, I got into trouble with iPhoto because it had a tendency to corrupt or mess up the database. And I didn't like the way I was being manipulated by the constraints of the early versions of iPhoto. And I kind of got out of it. And I tended to let the Finder manage my photos. Am I still making a big mistake?
It's So you have to, I've said many times about iTunes. iTunes is just a database. And you get people who grew up with either PCs or early computers where they would manage their music library in folders, and in the top level folder would be the artist, and the next folder would be the album, and then it would be the tracks. And there are so many people who want to control that and not let iTunes do it. Whereas iTunes is a database. It's designed to do that. It'll find where your files are. It'll organize them. iPhoto or Photos, they're similar with one difference. When you take a photo and put it in the Photos app and you edit that photo, Photos is going to keep the original photo and keep track of the edits. So this is what's called non-destructive editing. At any time, you can export the original unedited photo, which is useful. If you've edited something and you don't like it, you come back later, you want to go back to the original. When you keep something in the Finder, you don't have that option. You're going to be editing your files directly, and unless you save the originals when you make edits, your edits will be destructive. Mm-hmm. They will change the files permanently. Now, if something does get corrupted, worst case, you lose some of your edits or the history of your edits. You may have the edited photos and the originals. They're inside the package of the Photos library, and you can dig around to get them. It depends on how you want to work.
That's the part that's bothered me. If something goes wrong and it gets corrupted, your visibility and access into your files is difficult, and the export may not work anymore because it's mangled.
It's a tough call. The advantages of Photos are so many that I wouldn't think of working any other way. I know I can always go into the Photos library package in the masters folder and pull out the originals, worst case. But the advantages of the way it organizes files and the way you can edit in Photos make it far too compelling to not want to just leave Photos in the Finder, view them maybe with Quick Look or with some other app, maybe Graphic Converter, which does a good job of scanning through a folder and presenting the files in it. And it's the whole Apple ecosystem. When they're in the Photos library, they go up into the cloud if you want. You get them on your iPhone, your iPad. You can see them on your Apple TV. You know, there's all those advantages. Use Time Machine. Back up your library regularly. And worst case, if something happens, you just go back a day or a week and get another version of the library before it was corrupted.
That's true. Tell me about Aperture. As I recall, the project manager left and threw the Aperture team into a bit of a tizzy. Is that correct? And is Apple recovering?
I don't know the backstory. I never used Aperture. I didn't have that sort of need for it. It was a paid program and it did things that I wasn't interested in at the time. I don't know if I would use it today, given what I do with photography now, you know, having much better cameras than back when Aperture came out. I know a lot of people who felt really let down by Apple when Aperture was discontinued, and they look at Photos and they see all the features that are missing that they used to use in Aperture. For most people today, who all the hundreds of millions of people using iOS devices, you know, they don't even think about that. The Aperture was more geared toward professional photographers or serious enthusiast photographers. And I think most of them have just moved over to Adobe now and use Lightroom. There are a number of apps that are in the works to create a new digital asset management tool, which is what that is. In other words, it manages your photo library and your database as well as providing editing features. Skylum, who makes Luminar, they're working on something that should be out by the end of the year. Affinity Photo has said they're also doing something. So there is a lot of work in that space. Aperture was one of the, with Adobe, Aperture was the only real choice at the time. But we're actually in a golden age of photo apps on the Mac. Luminar and Affinity Photo are two examples. Pixelmator, Acorn. You have no end of choices for high-end photo editing apps on the Mac now.
Photo editing, but not necessarily library management.
Not necessarily digital asset management. So that's what Lightroom does. It does both, but one thing it does is it manages files. Lightroom manages files in folders in the Finder. So you can keep your Finder library and Lightroom manages them. when you make edits, it stores files that keep track of the edits. So you're actually more protected than you would be with the Photos database.
That sounds pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah, but it's the Adobe Industrial Complex. And you have to sign into that and you have to pay your monthly fee. And, you know, I'm really interested in photography. And I'm not really interested in playing around with my pictures on my computer. I'm more interested in taking pictures, trying to get good pictures. I'm studying composition. I'm studying lighting. Lately, I've been doing flower shots with lights and reflectors and things like that to learn about lighting. My edits are relatively limited, so I do most of my editing in Apple Photos. Now, there's the one great advantage of Apple Photos that you can open a photo and you can edit a file using an extension, another photo editing app on the Mac from within Photos. So Photos sends a file to that app. That app does the editing and sends it back. And you're still keeping your original that's unaltered. If you're in the Photos app, select a file, press return, you go into edit mode. Then there's a little button in the top right, which is a circle with an ellipsis in it. And if you click that, you'll see all of the apps that you have on your Mac that you can use to edit your photos.
Ah, cool.
So this makes Photos the digital asset managing tool that you can use with other apps, or it makes Photos the tool that you use both to manage your library and to organize your files.
Are we done with attachment lenses? You know, maybe the iPhone 4 to 6 range, there were lots of different companies that were building these add-on lenses that had longer
clip
focal
on,
lengths.
Yeah,
yeah, and the problem with that is that the perpetual problem is that they don't work well at all when you have a case on your phone. And with the iPhone,
or 10, some require that you use a special case.
Yeah, yeah, and with two lenses on the iPhone 10, and maybe, you know, an emerging trend, I'm beginning to suspect that the age of these add-on lenses may be coming to an end, because it's a new camera configuration, a new placement of the lenses, new kinds of lenses every year. You have a glass back on the iPhone 10. You've got to put a really good case on it. What do you think?
I've never used them. I was talking to someone yesterday who was telling me about a couple that he had tried out, and he said it was such a hassle because you've got to take it out and put it on and make sure it's lined up. Interestingly, while the smartphone has sort of overwhelmed photography, giving everyone a good quality camera in their pocket, the sort of, I don't want to say small camera, but new mirrorless cameras and Micro Four Thirds have been selling at record numbers. So more and more people are graduating from a smartphone to better cameras because the smartphone is good for certain types of photography, but not everything. A few months ago, my partner and I were coming back from the south of England, and we stopped off at Stonehenge, which was on the way. Now, you can't get very close to the stones in Stonehenge, so you could take a few photos with your iPhone, but they won't be that good. And I brought my real cameras with me, and I had a few lenses, and I was able to get some nice photos. So depending on what you're interested in photographing, the iPhone may never be good enough. But for many people, it's good enough for most of the time. And for most people, it's good enough for all the time.
They say the best camera you have is the one that's always in your pocket.
That's right. And the question is what you're going to be shooting, though. If you're shooting something that your iPhone will be able to capture because of the shutter speed, because of the light, because of the focal length of the lens, then it's fine. Otherwise, you just may miss your pictures. And that's just life. Unless you are someone who care about photography that much, who always has a camera strap over your shoulder, that iPhone is what you're going to use when you want to take a picture of something. But in that, the people who buy other cameras are more interested in pictures as a craft, as an art. Yes, there are lots of people who do that with an iPhone, but that's not the bulk of people who take pictures.
I have another question. A couple years ago, I don't remember when, Phil Schiller introduced a new feature that he thought was really cool in iPhoto, where it would extract the location data from the EXIF file and create a map of your photos, especially helpful for vacations where you look at a photo and you say, yeah, I know I was somewhere in London, but I don't remember exactly where. And you can put a little push pin on a map and identify where each photo was taken during your vacation. Is that still a thing? I haven't seen that mentioned in a long time.
Oh, that's a basic feature now, not only for the iPhone, but all smartphones. Some compact cameras, you don't generally find that built into a better camera because it hits battery life a lot. But the way it works with my two Fujifilm cameras is I launch an app on my iPhone, and this is essentially recording the times and the locations of where I am. When I'm finished for the day, I'll connect my camera to my iPhone, and it'll transfer the data, and it'll put that data into the files. So I'll have the location data. Another option is if you're shooting with a camera that doesn't even offer that feature, but you have an iPhone, take one photo with your iPhone where you are, and then take all your pictures with your other camera. When you get back, you'll have the location on the iPhone photo, and you can just see where that is and add that to the other photos.
Good idea. Good idea.
Data is useful because you can look at that map and say, okay, I know I went on this trip here, Stonehenge. Let me find all the photos from there.
Yeah, but there is one side issue that we've discussed before at the Mac Observer. I forget when. Maybe it was during a Daily Observations podcast with Jeff Gamet. But young people have to be careful about uploading photos to Instagram and other services, especially children and other people who are sensitive about their location. People can go to Instagram, people with evil intentions, and look at photos and then download the photo and extract the EXIF data, and then they get location data. And that can be a personal security issue. So if you want to prevent that, there's a way to turn off location data in your settings for the camera app. But if you use a different app for your photography, you have to watch out for that too. So that is a minor consideration. What do you think?
I agree. But while you were saying that, I just dragged a photo out of my photos library to the Finder, and I just opened it with a terminal command called EXIF tool. It's a terminal application that I've installed on my Mac, mm-hmm. and the location is not there when you take the file out of the photos library. When I use Instagram, I don't put locations. I don't want people to know where I am when I tweet, because it says, hey, I'm here, or hey, I'm not home. There's no one at my house.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that when you take a photo out of the photos library, it does not include that data. I've actually never really looked into it, but right now the photo that I just dragged does not have the location.
That's probably one of Apple's privacy considerations. Somebody thought of that and said, hey, this would be a smart thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what did we not cover that you want to talk about? We have just a few minutes left.
Well, I very much like black and white photography. And I don't have gear lust, you know, that desire to buy new stuff all the time. But there is one camera that I'd really like. It's called the Leica M Monochrome. It's quite an expensive camera, but it only shoots in black and white. Now, I can't afford this.
That's amazing.
It is. Well, it's amazing for many reasons. The quality of the sensor, since it's only collecting luminance data, is far superior to a color sensor.
Sure.
I would love to see Apple do what Huawei did with their phone. It's called the P20 Pro. It has three cameras in it. Two of them are color, and one of them is monochrome. Now, it uses the monochrome to build a picture to provide more contrast with the color, but you can also shoot monochrome directly. Now, I know you can still shoot monochrome from the iPhone with a black and white filter, but the quality isn't quite the same. And I know there's not that many people care about shooting black and white, at least if they're shooting smartphones. But I would like to see Apple do something like that. I think it's time for Apple to come out with some new feature for the camera, be it higher resolution or something like that. Going to three lenses, four lenses, five lenses, you know, that's like when the razor blades went from one to two to five and all that.
Yeah.
And it's just going to get too complicated. But the idea, I would love to have a monochrome camera. I wish someone made one that was less expensive. I won't go into detail, but if anyone's interested, just Google Leica M monochrome. You'll find some articles that explain why it's so much better to shoot in black and white with a black and white sensor.
All right. Well, cool. We are out of time now. I want to finish up with a mention that you're going to leverage all this expertise you have on photography. You are starting a new podcast with Jeff Carlson called Photo Active. Tell us about that.
Yes, Photo Active is a podcast about photography and the Apple ecosystem. And we're talking about photography in general, and we're talking about Apple products and Macs and iOS devices. Our latest episode was about shooting with the iPhone. We're not going to talk about gear. We're not going to talk about the latest lenses and the latest cameras and all that. We're more interested in the overarching elements of photography about how to take good pictures. You can find us at photoactive.co. That's photoactive.co because we could not afford the M.
I am not familiar with the .co domain.
Yeah, it's been around for a while. The .com would have cost $7,500 and the .co was $25. And that's better than .net and .biz and .everything else. So we went for photoactive.co, and that lets me use this little joke saying that we couldn't afford the end.
Cool. Okay, I will put that in the show notes. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. Thanks for joining me on the show and giving us a grand tour of Apple and photography. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me again, John.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for coming by. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week. Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you.